It's Sunday in New York City. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We are also now available on podcast on iTunes. Simply go to the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad and search for DC 37 State of the Union. And DC 37 members, there are now more ways to stay in touch with your union. You can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net. And every month, you can keep a lookout for your union newspaper, the Public Employee Press, in your mailbox. For this show, we're welcoming City Council member Helen Rosenthal. She is going to be with us discussing a bill that is co-sponsoring that would establish an office of tenant advocate within the Department of Buildings. Welcome to State of the Union, Council Member Rosenthal.
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm a huge fan.
Well, you're a good friend of the unions, and I know that you became City Council member in 2014. And I'm just curious as to how you made the decision to run for office. I'm always interested in how public service people came to be.
Well, I think my journey was a little different. I started working for the city. So on the administration side, I oversaw the budgets of the health agencies back in the Koch and Dinkins administration. So I really understood how government works, and then after that, I raised my kids and got to know my community really well and became a fierce community advocate, particularly for public school parents, and realized that the platform of the city council would be one where I could successfully advocate on behalf of my residents, whether they be public school parents or now my real passion is with helping people stay in their apartments. Affordable housing is, without a doubt, the biggest issue on the Upper West Side, and I think throughout the city it's the crux of whether or not people can stay in their homes and live in the city and even send their kids to school. So that's become an area of importance for me.
You know, I was in Washington for 6 years when Barack Obama became elected. I moved from New York City down to Washington, came back about 2 years ago. I was stunned by what had happened in the housing in terms of trying to find an apartment
impossible.
To live in. And it's just
impossible.
Unbelievable the amount of the amount, how much it costs for how little you get. And
that's right.
And something that's just about, and I'm also amazed about the empty space on the storefronts in New York City. And you must know this on the Upper West Side. You represent the Upper West Side. The number of empty storefronts and the number of expensive apartments, it's real estate has just gone a little bonkers.
That's right. It's all of a piece. That the market is out of control, and I don't have a 8-ball. I can't see into the future, but it's not bearable for people. Interestingly, the vacancies, they're a reflection of the same thing. Building owners, they say that their property taxes have gone up, the cost of keeping their building is higher, so they have to raise their commercial rent. By the same token, you see these buildings, retail shops, they've had a lease for the last 10 years. They've been successful. Rent has gone up by whatever, 1 or 2% every year. But now it's the end of the lease, and the building owner thinks they can get 3 times as much for the space. So they're out of luck.
And then
we see vacancies.
And vacancy, I'm not talking about like for 2 or 3 months. I mean, I'm talking about years.
No.
There are spaces that are there for years that are empty.
That's right. And this is, it's a terrible problem on the Upper West Side, but it's not unique to the Upper West Side.
Right.
It's a citywide problem and really needs a citywide solution, something that is doable, right? Not as, won't be challenged by the courts or something like that. So I think what the city council is coming up with, and you'll see this roll out over the next few months, is a layered solution. You know, there's going to have to be some sort of commercial zoning changes in different areas of the city, legislation that will try to get in front of the whole vacancy issue. We're just going to have to move in that direction. You know, the market is not functioning the way it should be.
Yes.
I think.
And now, so let's talk about this. Let's talk about this bill that is the goal of which is to establish an Office of the Tenant Advocate, which sounds like a wonderful idea, long overdue. Tell us how it works.
Well, this really, the genesis of this bill was after a couple years of having our storefront office, hearing the issues people walk in the door and tell us about, you know, we use in the district office, we use all the tools we can to try to keep people in their homes. And what we were noticing is that HPD is responsible, that's the Housing Preservation Department for the city. They're responsible for dealing with harassment, but most of the violations that get issued in the building and that the building owners use to harass people are building department violations. So in other words, people might have their heat and hot water cut off or repairs that aren't done for years, or even worse, a repair that's needed and then the super comes in and they say, oh, you need us to repair your sink? Fine. And then they just break the sink, which has happened. I mean, those are harassment issues, but it's the Department of Buildings that has to come out and issue the violation. And what struck us is, you know, we need somebody in the Department of Buildings who's advocating on behalf of the tenants. I understand that the mission of the Department of Buildings is to make sure that construction happens safely. And, you know, the Department of Buildings, I think, does a marvelous job in that regard. They try to do so many different things to keep people safe, you know, when buildings are going up. But the area where it's not really part of their mission, so this is why we had to make this an office of the tenant advocate, is they're not thinking about the person who lives in that apartment or lives in that building where the building owner is, you know, violating the quality of life for the people who live there.
Is there a similar position within HPD? I'm just curious as you're talking about, is there?
Yeah, it's more of, it's part of their mission.
Yes, that was going to, yeah, I asked the question, I thought, yes, hold on a second.
That's right.
And that's a difference.
And so,
there's a difference between that.
But it's a separate agency. And yes, there are people within each department that talk with each other and work together. Absolutely. But it's the Department of Buildings that signs off on the tenant protection plan, for example. And the way the tenant protection plan is worded, you would think that means protect the tenant, but if this is a boilerplate document that, you know, building owners hardly pay attention to when they are thinking about renovations in their buildings, and no one's in the agency really looking to make sure that that tenant protection plan does what it's supposed to do, and this office would now have the authority to, you know, say to the commissioner, you know what, this tenant protection plan is working. We need to stop this job until the construction crew really is protecting the tenants.
How prevalent is the problem of tenants being harassed now? I'm just curious as to whether there's been any progress made or where we are in 2017 in terms of what tenants' rights are.
You know, I can only speak to it from my office. I mean, what our experience is on the Upper West Side, and nothing has abated. We actually track the number of affordable housing units in the zip codes that my district covers. We lose about 300 to 400 units of affordable housing every year since I've been in office. And yet, you know, we're working our butts off with housing clinics and connecting people to lawyers. And we save many, many people from eviction, but the forces of the market, right in the place where you started this conversation, Chris, right. The forces of the market are so strong, and clearly building owners see, you know, they look at a rent-regulated apartment and they see dollar signs, and they just can't wait to get that person out. And I'm not talking about all building owners. Trust me, there are so many that are responsible, great landlords. And frankly, we work with them too. They're, you know, but the vast majority are on the Upper West Side are harassing their tenants in one way or another. You can't imagine what they come up with. If you have a minute, can I tell you a story about a thing that was just mind-numbing that we learned about a month ago? People came into our office and showed us a letter that they had just gotten from their landlord. And the letter said, for the next few weeks, we're going to be renovating the central stair in this building. So during this time, like from the period of, I forget, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. every day, if you need to go in and out, use the fire escape.
Oh, God.
Like, what?
And the 82-year-old Mrs. Jones on the third floor.
Correct.
Is, yeah, okay.
Correct.
Okay.
And the people in the front of the building, they have a fire escape. The people in the back, they don't even have a fire escape. So it turns out they have something different, something called a fire basket, where you go out of your apartment and you have to go to the building next door, bang on the window to get out.
Right.
I mean, you know, we come upon this stuff all the time. And, you know, with our office, fortunately, we have a very good relationship with the Department of Buildings. They were wonderfully, they were so helpful in stopping this job and in helping us investigate what was going on and making sure that the landlord did right by the tenant. But, you know, it's mind-numbing what's going on out there.
It certainly sounds that this is a bill whose with the time of which has come, that there's certainly a need for this. We're talking with Helen Rosenthal, who represents the 6th Council District on the Upper West Side of New York City. Listen, I appreciate your taking the time to I knew this was going to go by very quickly. I hope you are now going to be a regular guest on the show, and the best of luck to you.
Thanks so much, Chris. I'd love to come back anytime. You're asking all the right questions, the things that really matter both to the D.C. 37 population, but really the whole city. So thank you for giving us this opportunity.
Helen Rosenthal. We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. We're on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m., and you can catch us as a podcast. Just search your podcast app, DC 37 State of the Union. Our next guest is New York Daily News editorial writer Robert George. Mr. George, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Policano. How are you doing?
I'm okay. As I'm sitting here on Thursday morning, the show goes on the air on Sunday, so I have to make that the caveat, because in the world that we live in now, between Thursday morning and Sunday, God knows what will have happened. But I am looking at the Daily News this morning. The headline is "Grab 'em by their liberty." This is all about what happened yesterday on Wednesday with the immigration. You guys don't seem to be too supportive of what the president has proposed.
I think that's a fair point, actually. Because so much stuff was going on, we decided to hold off on editorializing on the actual policy, and that'll be in tomorrow's paper. But just to give, well, I was going to say to give you a preview, but it'll be in print. But you know, by the time folks are listening to this, the administration, well, going back to last year, the president, the now president's main message has always been illegal immigration and the whole wall concept and trying to ban Muslims and so on and so forth. But he is putting his name behind this bill that the two senators, Tom Cotton from Arkansas and David Perdue from Georgia, are pushing forward, which will seriously roll back the number of legal immigrants coming into the country. Right now, the annual number is about a million, and they want to impose an immediate cap, which would reduce it by 40% over the next year, and then by more than 50%, I think, in like the 5 to 10 years after that. And to do this, they would change the preference requirements on who gets in. Right now, there's the bias is slightly towards families and so forth. They would now change that to what they call a merit based, which means it would be more of a premium on high skilled immigrants as opposed to low skilled immigrants. Our view on it would be, look, fine, if you want to put a slight preference on people with high skills, we're supportive of, you know, expanding the H-1B visa program. We certainly want more smart people coming into the country as well. But we also think it's foolish to block out those others who also want to come into the country. New York, in particular, would not be the city it is without immigrants, both high skilled and low skilled. And you're talking to one right here. My mother and I came to the United States 40 years ago when she was a nurse, and she got a job with Mount Sinai Hospital was advertising overseas. We were living in England at the time. She applied, and they brought us over, and it's been, you know, the wonderful the great experience and the continuing adventure of my life. And I like to think, you know, I may have contributed a few things to the life of America as well. So
and many of us agree with that, by the way, Robert.
Thank you. Okay. And it's also the case that limiting immigration has a adverse impact on economic growth as well. So if the President of the United States is talking about wanting to make America great again, well, America became great because of the contributions of immigrants, and it's, you know, so this seems unwise and not completely well thought out. Well, you know, surprise.
Well,
that seems to that seems to be a rather common common occurrence in the 6 months of this administration so far.
You're a thoughtful fellow. You seem to be discussing this in terms of the substance of the issue. However, most folks yesterday were more wrapped up in the way, once again, style over substance. Not that there isn't much to disagree about on the substance, but the fact that there wound up being the face of the White House wound up, pretty much spitting on the Statue of Liberty and what's said on the base of the Statue of Liberty and what the American dream is. And if that isn't an example of getting lost in the translation, I don't know what is. I mean, this White House seems obsessed with putting its worst foot forward.
I can't disagree with that. And I'm going to try and put on my fair hat here. The Statue of Liberty has become synonymous with the idea of immigration and welcoming new people to the country. Though that sort of happened a little bit later. The statue was a gift from the French on the 100th anniversary of the Declaration and so forth. The poem, "Give Me Your Tired, Your Poor," and so forth, that was kind of added on about 10 years later when they were doing like a fundraising drive for the upkeep of the statue and so forth. So just so people know what the facts are. But that said, we have been this weird mix of a weird mixture of a country in terms of multiple ethnicities and race and things like that. Now it was a few months ago. Everybody got really upset when Dr. Ben Carson, talked about the immigrant experience of African Americans coming here, which was like slightly different than that of some of the other immigrants. But that said, it does speak to the truly multicultural, different avenues which all ended up in America and still continues to make this multicultural nation. And the immigrant experience is part of that. And there seems to be this inability for this administration to really recognize and weave in that story. I will say this, and this is something I think it's important for listeners to keep track of. What the administration is doing, both on this issue, and also with these reports about how they are looking at affirmative action and unraveling that. Part of the talking points, and this was notable in the press conference that Stephen Miller, who's one of the key aides in the White House, he was mixing it up with the press on Wednesday when they were unrolling the immigration policy. They were saying that one of the reasons why they want to limit immigration or bring the numbers down is because of the impact that it is having on current low income Americans and current immigrants who are already here. So they are, in a sense, trying to play the diversity angle, for want of a better phrase, by saying that that high levels of immigration adversely impact the immigrants here as well as other blue-collar Americans. And they're doing the same thing with the affirmative action as well. They're saying that if we don't address affirmative action appropriately, it's impacting Asian reverse discrimination is impacting Asian Americans. So it's kind of interesting to see how the how this administration decides to sort of adopt some of the language of the traditional left in focus in trying to say, you know, we're concerned about diverse groups that are being unfairly impacted by the status quo.
Daily News editorial writer Robert Judge, I knew this was going to fly by. I just want to point out that the Daily News has brought back a Labor Beat reporter and has made a commitment to our city's working families. They're also offering a steep solidarity discount for union members and their families and friends. Find out more about that on the DC 37 Facebook page. Robert, thank you very much for taking the time to explain what's been going on in the last few days.
We do our best. Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
That's just about all the time we have for this week. I want to thank my guests, Council Member Helen Rosenthal and Daily News Editorial Board Member Robert Judge. Before we go, the great James Baldwin would have been 93 years old this week. He's been gone for 30 years. Like perhaps many of you listening to this, I discovered James Baldwin in high school, which is a difficult time in any person's life, especially if he or she has no idea what they want to do for the rest of their life. Baldwin rescued a lot of us from ourselves, I think. He was a small, wise, pop-eyed poet who spoke of pain and pride and loss and longing in a whole new passionate language, the likes of which I had never heard before. And I want to end this show with a few minutes of James Baldwin talking to a group of young people and wishing that he was still around to be talking to us.
One, a baby's not born with any idea of a society, no sense whatever of other people. Its mother exists principally, in fact, entirely for him or her, and its father exists somewhat later, entirely for him or her. It's only much, much later that the baby begins to realize that the parent on whom he depended for everything and whom he supposed held up the world is in fact just another human being who was not invented for him. That is, on the most primary level, one of the meanings of an education. On another level, it is the only way that one is enabled to enlarge the world. Now that sounds like a very grandiose phrase. All it means is that when you, for example, begin to read, you discover more about the world than you knew before. You discover more about the world in two ways, and this is why it is important. There being, in fact, two worlds. One world is you. That this envelope, I'm a world. I am not the only world, that's my problem. But I am a world, and I am under the obligation to discover whatever it is that goes on in that world. And in order to do that, I have got to consent to become a social animal in order to discover and to enlarge what goes on in this world, which is all of you and many millions of people, both living and dead, past and to come. And finally, this is where it begins to be difficult. The measure of one's dignity depends on one's estimate of oneself. It really does not depend, as so many people in this country now seem to believe, on someone else's estimate. It depends, first of all, on what you take yourself to be, what your real standards are, what you think is right, what you think is wrong, what you think life is all about, what you think life is for.